26 from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. They're hosting an eat and greet in the Menlo Park Park and Ride parking lot at 122nd and East Burnside. There's going to be live music, free food, activities, and plenty of friendly faces. Find them online at cultivateinitiatives.org. Interested in discovering and tracking wildlife around Portland? Portland Audubon Society, which recently voted to change its name, and we'll hear more about that in the future, is working with the Urban Wildlife Information Network's Camera Trap Training and Volunteer Meetup on May 25th. It's at the Portland Audubon offices in Heron Hall at 5151 North Cornell Road, Thursday, May 25th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Find out more at audubonportland.org. Learn more about the Urban Wildlife Information Network online at urbanwildlifeinfo.org. Street Roots, the best grassroots newspaper around, is building up Old Town by taking over a gigantic old dilapidated building and redeveloping it for the people. Find out more in person every Thursday from 5 p.m. to 5:50 p.m. at Barnes & Morgan on North West 2nd Avenue. Kaya Sand, Executive Director of Street Roots and Friends, are there for a low-key chat about their capital campaign progress and future plans. Barnes & Morgan is at 131 Northwest 2nd Avenue in Portland, Oregon. RSVP optional and appreciated. Portland District Commissions. By the end of this month, the Independent District Commission deliberates and votes on their district plans for the four political districts from which Portlanders will elect 12 members of City Council. Maps are being considered now. Plug in and share your thoughts. Wednesday, May 31st, attend the Commission's work session, or you can submit a comment through their online public comment form, or you can email it to districtcommission@portlandoregon.gov, or you can call it in on the phone through the 311 number. That's just you dialing 311. In July, the commission will hold 8 to-be-announced public hearings to take official comment to in each proposed district. Find out more. portland.gov/transition/district-commission. That's portland.gov/transition/district-commission. This has been the Keeping It Real grassroots community calendar for Portland, Oregon through May 31st, 2023. Make us bigger by sending in your events from Vancouver and the Hood River and Corvallis area, in addition to Portland. Find me, Lisa Loving, on social media. I am very easy to find on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Be sure to include time, place, and manner, who, what, when, where, how, and why, with info on how people can connect to your group. You should be a grassroots broadcaster too. Find out how by emailing volunteer@kbu.org. You are listening to KBU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Stay tuned.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kbu.fm. KBU's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kbu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBU. 2 hours of global bass with an emphasis on South Asia and the South Asian diaspora, and an even more special emphasis on the Punjabi diaspora. Hosted every Tuesday, 10 to midnight, by the Incredible Kid. This ain't world music, it's birth of a new world music.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Today on Wings. I was a token woman poet for many years. White patriarchy doesn't want more than a certain few women poets to exist. You know, if you put together an anthology, if you're editing a book or whatever on the state of poetry today, those are the ones you allude to. You know, they're the two dead ladies, and then there's me.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. A much-loved literary heroine and thinker of the women's movement died March 27, 2012. Adrienne Rich was born May 16, 1929. In 1951, she graduated from Radcliffe College, the women's undergraduate program of Harvard, and that's also the year her poetry book, A Change of World, was selected by W.H. Auden for the Yale Younger Poets Prize.
I felt at college very alienated from the Harvard literary scene. I was a woman. But I was told by a teacher, I think one of my writing teachers, that there was this prize and that I probably had enough poems to make a manuscript, and why didn't I just try for it? And I put together the manuscript, not really believing that anything was going to happen. And then in the middle of the summer got a letter in, I will always remember, written in turquoise ink from W.H. Auden, saying that this book had been selected, and I was totally shaken. I didn't know how to deal with it. You have to remember that this was 1950, and being a woman, according to the expectations of the 1950s, that seemed in total conflict. So it was a very overwhelming thing, and fundamentally what I think I did was to flee from it in various ways, and one of the ways was getting married and having three children very fast. I mean, that wasn't the only thing that the marriage was about or that having the children was about, but it was part of it.
What do you think has changed the most in your understanding of yourself as a poet from that time to this?
Well, I started out as a very technically accomplished formalist poet, and I thought of my poems in that period very much as these beautiful, hopefully beautiful boxes which I was building, and which, you know, when the box snapped shut, it was finished, perfect, and you moved on to the next box.
Like a jewel.
And whatever was in those boxes was to stay inside.
And not get messy and into your life.
Not get messy and into my life, and all kinds of things in my life were not supposed to be visible in the poems. As I went along and into the 50s, into marriage, motherhood, and many other things, I increasingly couldn't write that kind of poem anymore, and increasingly found myself writing what, you know, is sometimes called free verse, sometimes organic form, but at all events needing a much more open-ended kind of structure within which to begin to try to probe some of the things I was living through. And it was very indirect at first and still very defended, but I think that the whole process for me has been gradually shedding all kinds of defenses.
That was Adrienne Rich in 1983, interviewed by Eloise Klein Healy for Pacifica Radio. Starting with the book Snapshots of a Daughter-in-Law, published in 1963, Rich began a process of becoming more political and more self-revealing in her work. Divisions of Labor was written in 1988.
This is called Divisions of Labor. The revolutions wheel, compromise, utter their statements. A new magazine appears, mast-headed with old names. An old magazine polishes up its act with deconstructions of the prose of Malcolm X. The women in the back rows of politics are still licking thread to slip into the needle's eye, trading bones for plastic,
splitting pods for necklaces to sell to the cruise ships, producing immaculate First Communion dresses with flat iron and irresolute hot water, still fitting the microscopic golden wires into the silicon chips, still teaching, watching the children quenched in the crossfire alleys, the flash flood gullies, the kerosene flash fires, the women whose labor remakes the world each and every morning. I have seen a woman sitting between the stove and the stars, her fingers singed from snuffing out the candles of pure theory, finger and thumb both scorched. I have felt that sacred wax blister my hand.
In 1976, after her husband had died and her sons were grown, Adrienne Rich embarked on a lifelong lesbian relationship with another poet, Michelle Cliff. This is Edgelit from the book Dark Fields of the Republic, published in 1996.
Edgelit, living under fire in the rain-colored opal of your love, I could have forgotten other women I desired so much I wanted to love them, but here are some reasons love would not let me. One had a trick of dropping her lashes along her cheekbone in an amazing screen so she saw nothing. Another would stand in summer, arms rounded and warm, catching wild apricots that fell either side of a broken fence, but she caught them on one side only. One, ambitious, flushed to the collarbone, a shapely coward. One, keen as mica, glittering, full at the lips, absent at the core. One who flirted with danger, had her escape route planned when others had none, and disappeared. One sleepwalking on the trestle of privilege, dreaming of innocence, tossing her cigarette into the dry gully, an innocent gesture.
Rich's first overtly lesbian poetry appears in the 1978 collection The Dream of a Common Language. Also in the late 1970s, Rich began publishing nonfiction prose. Two books that became feminist classics are Of Woman Born, Motherhood as Experience and Institution, 1976, and On Lies, Secrets, and Silence, 1979. In 1980, she wrote the essay Compulsory Heterosexuality and Lesbian Existence. Rich spoke with Eloise Klein Healy about being out as a lesbian.
I don't know that everyone has this experience, and I think a lot depends on the age at which you acknowledge yourself as a lesbian, that you acknowledge that you are in love with a woman madly, physically, passionately, erotically. And I was in my 40s, and I felt elated. I mean, for a long time I had thought that I couldn't possibly be a lesbian. You know, I had been married, I had had these children, you know, all the things that people say. And but women were the only people who interested me. They alone stirred my imagination, as Virginia Woolf said. And I guess for me it felt initially like this incredible gift. And I wasn't facing at that point the kind of situation that a lot of my friends have faced with, say, a child and a custody case and a jealous husband. I wasn't faced with having to make some kind of immediate sacrifice. And it was fueling my work incredibly.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yet, over and over and over again, I have found myself feeling that I have to come out to people, and I'm particularly in public situations, because there are so many who don't want me to be this, who don't want it to be true of me, because when I came out, I already had a certain reputation.
You certainly
did.
I was
a sort of establishment poet.
Right.
And well-credentialed by the boys and mm-hmm. all of that. So that, I mean, I constantly feel I'm having to make this point, which is annoying and maddening. But I will make it as long as they want us to step back in the closet.
On Wings, you're listening to a tribute to the poet Adrian Rich, who died March 27th, 2012. Rich was a tremendous champion of other writers, especially women writers and black writers. In 1974, when the National Book Award was split between herself and Allen Ginsberg, Rich invited the two black women feminists who had also been nominated, Alice Walker and Audre Lorde, to accept with her on behalf of all women. Here's a poem Rich wrote about her friendship with another black poet, June Jordan.
And this is dedicated to the late poet June Jordan. When we are shaken out, when we are shaken out to the last vestige, when history is done with us, when our late grains glitter, salt swept into shadow, indignant and importunate strife-fractured crystals, will it matter if our tenderness, our solidarity, abides in residue, long as there's tenderness and solidarity? Could the tempos and attunements of my voice, or in a poem, or yours and mine, in telephonic high hilarity, cresting above some stupefied inanity, be more than personal? And, as you once said, what's wrong with that?
Adrian Rich talked about her early apprehension of racism and prejudice in the 1983 Pacifica interview.
My father was a Jew. My father's mother was Jewish. And my mother is a Gentile and comes of that WASP stock. Southern, however, and all of my family, my kin, are in the Deep South, what's left of my family, with the exception of my mother and my sister. I grew up in an extremely segregated situation where we did not see black people who were not servants of the white middle class. I don't think it was until I was in high school that I was in a room with black students, and certainly only in college had any real contact with black people who were not working for somebody's family. There were also all of the kinds of silences that go on around genteel racism. I mean, I didn't know anything about lynching, for example, until I was much older. At the same time, the word Negro was always uttered in a kind of half whisper, as though it were itself too heavy, too weighty to be spoken in a normal voice. I think that any child growing up in this kind of situation knows that there is an enormous amount of tension among the adults, that there are strange things going on that are never alluded to and never explained. There are certain tones of voice that you say, hear your mother adopt when speaking to a black person, and it makes you incredibly uncomfortable, but you don't know why. And then after a while, you learn to
be
talk that way. I mean, I think that there are all kinds of things which could not have been identified at that time by me, and which I was very grateful to writers like Lillian Smith for identifying. I began reading James Baldwin in the early 50s with enormous relief and feeling that here was someone saying things that I needed to know, and it was so clarifying, and it was like suddenly there were names for these inchoate, awful feelings. And then the civil rights movement, moving into that, beginning to have a sense of the history of black people in this country and the history of racism in this country, beginning to have a sense that there was also a history of struggle, of resistance, that the things that we had been taught in school about happy slaves were a pack of lies. Mm-hmm. Beginning also to suspect that a great deal else that I had been told about many things was a pack of lies. And feeling tremendously moved by the cadences of especially the prose writers, and finally beginning to get involved on a very minor level, partly through teaching, partly through writing. But I think that feminism was very decisive for me. I was saying to a friend today with whom I had lunch that although I was thinking about a lot of these things earlier, including things like Jewish identity and anti-Semitism, racism, war, that feminism was a kind of portal through which I, if I stepped, it seemed to me I would forever after have to be confronting these things. There was no way of dropping back into some safe place, because I feel feminism as a kind of accountability of women to women, for women, and as calling on us to be aware of the lives of women very unlike ourselves and of our own difference.
Adrienne Rich continued her activism, notably anti-war activism, into the early 2000s. In 1995, when she was 66 years old, she talked of writing about activism to interviewer Helene Rosenbluth at KPFA in Berkeley, California.
I wanted to write a poem which would in some way be expressive of the emotional subjectivity of political movements and political commitments. I wanted to try to write about, and this is partly because, you know, we've all seen the movements of the 60s, let's say, or, you know, any other movement, the women's movement or whatever, encapsulated and frozen and not only denigrated, but oversimplified, turned into some kind of formula. And I wanted to write poetry which would somehow have the, I could almost say the rhythms, the current, the flow of what it is like to be with others in a liberatory movement. And that's what this poem really came out of. It became a lot of other things as well. But, and I was trying for a much, you know, a much more almost collage-like style than I had attempted for a long time in poetry. I was letting myself go in a lot of directions. And I have to say that the work of a number of other women in particular was very helpful to me in finding ways of doing this. I'm thinking of the Irish poet Maeve McGuckian, who actually comes into the poem with a postcard, whose work really has fascinated me. And the late American poet Linda Hull, now I'm going to forget the title of her posthumous volume, which is really a wonderful book. I'm sorry that I'm forgetting that title, but it's a poetry of such energy, and it's a poetry that is really dealing with bleakness, harshness, and despair in a very exhilarating way. And a book that came out a couple of years ago by Donna Massini called That Kind of Danger. Work like this has been really important to me in sort of moving into a line and a tempo and a kind of energy that I needed for this particular poem. And so that's where Inscriptions comes from. And the poem Comrade, I don't know if you want me to read. Okay. It's the first poem in the sequence. Little as I knew you, I know you. Little as you knew me, you know me. That's the light we stand under when we meet. I've looked into flecked jaws, walked injured beaches foot slick in oil, watching licked birds stumble in flight, while you, drawn through the pupil of your eye, across your own oceans in visionary pain and in relief, headlong and by choice, took on the work of charting your city's wounds, ancient and fertile, listening for voices within and against. My testimony, yours, trying to keep faith, not with each other exactly, yet it's the one known and unknown who stands for, imagines the other with whom faith could be kept. In city, your mind burns, wanes, waxes with hope. No stranger to bleakness, you. Worms have toothed at your truths, but you were honest regarding that. You conspired to compile the illegal discography of songs forbidden to sing or to be heard. If there were ethical flowers, one would surely be yours, and I'd hand it to you headlong across landmines, across city's wireless sleeplight. I'd hand it purposefully with love, a hand trying to keep beauty afloat on the bacterial waters. When a voice learns to sing, it can be heard as dangerous. When a voice learns to listen, it can be heard as desperate. The self unlocked to many selves, a mirror handed to one who just released from the locked ward, from solitary, from preventive detention, sees in her thicket of hair, her lost eyebrows, whole populations. One who discharged from war stares in the looking glass of home at what he finds there, sees in the undischarged tumult of his own eye how thick-skinned peace is and those who claim to promote it.
The poem Comrade, part of Inscriptions, part of a bigger book, Dark Fields of the Republic, by my guest, Adrienne Rich. I just have one question in that particular poem, and that is when I'm reading it, I must say I picture women speaking to women, and then I was just taken aback a little bit by the pronoun he towards the end of the poem. I wondered what that represented for you.
Well, I didn't mean this poem to be only about women speaking to women. I think that for me at this point, there are poems in which I'm certainly speaking to women, and they're in this book. I think that we all speak knowing that we're overheard to whomever we're speaking, if we're speaking in print, if we're making art and putting it out there, we hope to be overheard. We hope not only to be heard by the person who is addressed, or even the people who are addressed. And I think of this poem as this whole book, certainly, as was An Atlas of the Difficult World, as very much a book for and addressed to those who can use it, those who want it.
So it's interesting now that to be inclusionary, poets like Adrienne Rich will use the word he, because in so many other... And not that you haven't in other poems, but when we talk about inclusionary words, whether it be in liturgy or whether it be in poems that we can identify with, we so often are looking to male poets to male writers to include women. And it's interesting to see that in your poems, too, the inclusionary factor now is including men into what has been for so long been accessible to everybody, but specifically to so many women who have seen everything from A Woman Born back in the 70s as so radical, and finally a piece of work that speaks to the soul of women. And I'm wondering what kind of reaction you have gotten, both, I know this book is so new and just out, but to your other work, from more and more the mainstream.
From the mainstream? I don't know. What kind of reaction do you mean? I mean, I feel as if I've been sort of strangely rewarded for doing what I do, and it's been in many ways puzzling to me, and it's made me think a lot about where these rewards come from and what do they mean. I suppose that I've known for a long time that a great many men read my work, and that, you know, there were women who, when A Woman Born was published, found it depressing, couldn't finish it, hated it. You know, I don't know that these things really, we're not talking now about institutions like religious institutions. I think a work of art goes out in the world, and I'm not sure that it ever is received only along gender lines. I think that in the late 60s and early 70s, we were fighting very hard just to reclaim the fact that there was a tradition of women writing at all. That's very hard for people to understand today. It's very hard to remember, you know, even what that was like. Not a single women's bookstore, not a single women's section in any bookstore, not a single lesbian section in any bookstore. Most of the books that we, you know, have been reading over the past 20 years, either out of print or not even published. So, and you must remember this. You must remember this.
That's why we're so happy we have you on tape.
Adrian Rich's last collection of poetry was Tonight No Poetry Will Serve, poems 2007 to 2010. She died of advanced rheumatoid arthritis in March of 2012, close to her 83rd birthday. For the audio in this program, Wings thanks Helene Rosenbluth, the Pacifica National Archive, Women on the Line, and the University of Pennsylvania Online Writers Archive, PennSound. Readings on PennSound took place also at the State University of New York at Buffalo and San Francisco State University. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. We appreciate the support of your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Medea Benjamin. I hope you listen to Community Radio KBOO 90.7.
Today on Wings, Mayan Weaving Revival in Guatemala, following an era of genocidal repression against the indigenous people.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In a small town in Guatemala, indigenous Mayan women are reviving an ancient skill. Anna Catherine Brigida reports for Wings.
It's an overcast Tuesday afternoon in Santiago Zacatepeques, a small town about an hour from Guatemala City and a half hour from colonial tourist town Antigua. Of the roughly 30,000 residents, about 80% are indigenous Mayans from the Cachiquel community. Weaving has been part of their culture for centuries, but lately, fewer and fewer women know how to weave the traditional Mayan textiles.
No está bien el choco y tiene que volver a hacer. Aquí está todo enredado.
A teacher gives instructions to her students learning how to weave. You take two, leave one, and take two, she tells them, explaining how to guide and arrange the threads. The group of women sit on plastic chairs in front of backstrap looms, a type of weaving tool typical in Mayan culture. The backstrap loom is simple, and it can be easily taken anywhere. It's been an important part of Mayan culture for centuries. Mayan women often set it up in their home to weave. And years ago, they could also take it to the fields, or anywhere else where they wanted to work on their weaving.
Agarra dos, deja uno y agarra dos.
Sí, así.
Sí.
This group of women is learning to maneuver the backstrap loom to weave traditional patterns. Some are dressed in skirts and traditional Mayan blouses called huipiles. Others wear casual jeans and t-shirts. They all work in quiet concentration. Children play in the corner while their moms are hard at work. Occasionally a light banging sound cuts through the quiet as one woman grabs the beater by each side. That's one of the sticks in the middle of the loom, and pulls it down forcefully to keep the thread closely packed.
En años anteriores, la vida aquí fue muy difícil.
27-year-old Hilda Coralia Mecoricote is one of the women in the group learning how to weave. Unfortunately, her mother wasn't able to teach her.
Entonces, mi mamá, desde pequeña,
years ago, life was very difficult for us. My mom went to work in Guatemala City at a young age without knowing Spanish. It was very difficult for her to leave her town and go to the capital. Her mom died when she was really young, so she didn't have anyone to teach her to weave.
Igual desde pequeñas nos mandaron a trabajar a la capital, entonces.
For us, me and my sisters, it was the same reason. They sent us to the capital at a young age, so the tradition of weaving was lost in my family for that reason.
Se perdió el tejido, se perdió en mi familia por esa razón.
As a young girl, Hilda worked cleaning houses for Guatemala City's wealthy families. It was there that she was first exposed to the discrimination that many indigenous Guatemalans face. And this discrimination was directly related to her clothing. She worked with other girls cleaning houses. But unlike Hilda, these girls were non-indigenous Guatemalans, sometimes referred to as Ladinos. As Hilda recalls her experience years later, it still upsets her.
Sí. Fue un poco, no puedo con eso. Fue duro cuando yo fui a trabajar a la.
It was really difficult when I went to work in the capital. They made me take off my traditional clothing, and they forced me to use a uniform. Even though the other workers who were Latinas didn't use a uniform. Just me, because I am indigenous.
No usan uniform, solo yo. Por ser indígena.
The experience made Hilda feel ashamed of her culture. She started to reject her indigenous roots. She lashed out against them, in a way that many teenagers rebel against the traditions and values they are taught in their childhood, especially when society makes them feel different. So around the age of 16, Hilda stopped wearing skirts and huipiles. Instead, she opted for jeans and t-shirts.
My mom was not really in agreement with my decision, but it was starting to become more common in Santiago. Some people started to see it as normal, since not as many people wear traditional clothes. She started to accept it with time, and the rest of my family never said anything.
But like many teenagers, Hilda soon outgrew this phase. She slowly began to change her opinion about wearing traditional Mayan clothes. She got married and moved back to Santiago Zacatepeques with her husband. Now she has two children, ages 4 and 5. Once back in Santiago, Hilda reconnected with her roots. She started thinking about her children and what she wants to pass on to them. And as she started to think about this, she began wearing huipiles again. On the day I spoke to her, she was wearing a purple, blue, and green huipil with jewels around the collar and a striped skirt.
Tengo 27 años, y la verdad fue un poco difícil porque.
Now I'm 27. And the truth is, it was hard for me because in my adolescence, I lost myself trying to be accepted. For a long time, I stopped wearing traditional clothes because the racism here is so, so strong. When someone is looking for acceptance, sometimes they do things just because. Not too long ago, I started to realize how important it is to have a history and how great it is to be an indigenous person and the great value that we have. Many indigenous Guatemalan women never learned to weave for the same reasons as Hilda: discrimination, urban migration, and the intergenerational loss of the practice. Indigenous Guatemalan women are among the most poor and vulnerable in the country. Now, more and more women have to work to support their families. After a long day's work, they may not have time to work on weaving a tablecloth or a huipil, a traditional Mayan blouse. Many women also stopped weaving during the country's civil war, from 1960 to 1996. During that time, indigenous people were targeted by the military, which carried out massacres and forced disappearances in these communities. Some had to flee to the mountains to keep themselves safe. This meant weaving was no longer a priority. The loss of the tradition becomes more prominent over generations. For young Guatemalan women, if your mother never learned to weave, you won't have anyone to teach you. Somewhere between 40 and 50% of Guatemala's population identifies as Mayan. Their ancestors built the vast Mayan empire and made contributions to art, astronomy, and mathematics that are still important to this day. Mayan civilization stretched from southeastern Mexico to western El Salvador and Honduras, and covered all of current-day Guatemala and Belize. The Mayans built vast temples and pyramids, many which have now become major tourist destinations in the region. Over the course of thousands of years, from around 2000 BC to 1500 AD, the Mayans created their own writing system, produced stunning art and architecture, and developed a respected method of studying astrology. Weaving is intertwined with the rich traditions of the Mayans in Guatemala. In the Mayan cosmovision, the goddess Ixchel is believed to have started weaving in order to set the world in motion. Ixchel is often depicted with a backstrap loom, similar to the ones that students like Hilda are learning to weave with. Hilda has learned to respect and appreciate these traditions, despite her short period of adolescent rebellion. But the history of Guatemala's indigenous people has not always been respected in the country. Since Spanish colonization of Guatemala in the 16th century, indigenous Guatemalans have been treated as second-class citizens. During the country's civil war, which lasted from 1960 to 1996, the indigenous population was particularly vulnerable. The conflict was a battle between a leftist guerrilla insurgency and a series of repressive military regimes backed by the United States. At that time, the Guatemalan state carried out a military campaign to systematically kill and disappear indigenous Guatemalans. The rationale behind the strategy was that all indigenous Guatemalans were part of the country's leftist guerrilla insurgency. Or, even if they weren't directly involved in the fighting, the military believed all indigenous people at least felt sympathetic to the leftist guerrillas. So at that time, wearing traditional Mayan clothes could be dangerous, since it was the easiest way to identify someone as indigenous. An estimated 200,000 people were killed during Guatemala's civil war, plus another 45,000 people were forcibly disappeared. A truth commission later found that more than 80% of the victims during the conflict were indigenous. It also found that the state was responsible for 93% of the human rights abuses committed during that time. Needless to say, the Civil War period was no easy time to be indigenous in Guatemala. Out of fear, many indigenous Guatemalans stopped wearing their traditional clothing. It was a way of survival. Mothers stopped teaching their daughters to weave, and now Guatemala is left with a generation unable to pass down this tradition. But women like Hilda are working to bring it back. They've decided to take classes to learn to weave. In indigenous communities, weaving is not just about making clothes. It's about carrying on history and traditions. It's about showing pride in who you are. It's a way to reconnect with your roots.
Para mí, tejer significa
como recuperar lo que soy.
To me, weaving means recovering who I am and who we are as indigenous Kachikel women. I think that for me, that's the most important thing.
Un poco de historia otra vez a mi familia y no dejar que mis hijos olviden quiénes somos y de dónde venimos.
Since Guatemala signed a peace accord agreement that ended the civil war in 1996, indigenous Guatemalans have slowly started to shake off the fear of repression that stuck with them through that period and in the years after. A series of human rights trials has been a key part in making indigenous Guatemalans feel like they belong in their own country. One of the most important cases is the genocide trial of former dictator Efraín Ríos Montt. In 2013, Ríos Montt faced a long trial where many indigenous people found the courage to testify. The former military general was found guilty of genocide for ordering massacres against indigenous Mayan people during the early 1980s. When the verdict was announced, the courtroom broke into applause. This soon turned into the chant, "Sí, hubo genocidio," which means, yes, there was genocide. This is the case that many indigenous Guatemalans point to as the turning point for the country. Before, it was unheard of to see a military officer and a former president behind bars. But the celebrations were cut short. The forces of the military elites in the country were not so keen on letting go of the power they've long held. 10 days later, the verdict was ruled invalid based on a technicality.
On Wings, you are listening to a documentary about indigenous women in Guatemala using weaving to help heal themselves from the decades-long genocidal war against their people. After his conviction for genocide was overturned on a technicality, former President Ríos Montt was again put on trial, this time in a closed courtroom. He died of a heart attack at age 91 before that trial was complete. But the term genocide was understood to have been proven. Again, here's producer Anna Catherine Brigida.
As is often the case during a war, rape and sexual violence were used as tools of repression against women. One case in particular stands out for its importance to indigenous women. In 1992, the Guatemalan military murdered and disappeared a group of men who were defending their land against exploitation. This was in a town called Sepúr Zarco, a Mayan Quiché community in the Guatemalan department of Izabal. After killing the husbands, the military officers then forced the wives to become their servants. These women served as both house workers and sex slaves. More than 3 decades later, some of the military officers were put on trial. In 2016, 2 high-ranking military officers were convicted of crimes against humanity for rape, murder, and slavery in the Sepúr Zarco case. It was the first conviction for sex slavery as a war crime. The verdict was praised by the international community as an important step that helped to strengthen the rule of law for the rights of indigenous women in Guatemala. But there is still a long way to go. The country has some of the highest rates of domestic violence and femicide in the world. Life is even harder for indigenous women. They have a higher chance of being sick, illiterate, and poor than their non-indigenous counterparts. In the Guatemalan context, weaving can be an act of resistance for indigenous women. This is a resistance that dates back to the colonization by the Spanish.
It is resistance what we are doing because they even teach us in school that before the Spanish arrived, we Mayans were naked. But it's a lie because in history and in the archaeological sites, there is proof. Our clothing is something that they couldn't destroy. But if we look at our history, this is something that they wanted to erase. All of the evidence that we already had our own clothes and that we were civilized. According to them, they wanted to make us believe that we didn't have anything, that we were ignorant and that we were removed from our civilization. But it's a lie, because we were already clothed when the Spanish came. So with our huipil, we guard our history and something that they couldn't destroy.
Entonces nuestro huipil, pues ahí guardamos toda la historia también de nosotros, algo que ellos no pudieron destruir. ¿Sí?
That was Martha Julia, the instructor at the weaving school in Santiago Zacatepeques. The school is a project started by the Women's Association for the Development of Zacatepeques, known by the Spanish acronym AFEDES. The organization is dedicated to supporting indigenous women, and it has launched a range of initiatives to promote the tradition of weaving in Mayan communities. Since the school began more than a decade ago, AFEDES has helped 1,500 women learn to weave. This current session has about a dozen students. They meet on Tuesdays and Fridays for 3 hours from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. While they are in class, the women work diligently and patiently hunched over their looms. The progress made in one class can seem small, just a few inches added to the cloth napkins each student was working on. Weaving requires a lot of patience. It's a process that cannot be rushed. The instructor, Martha Julia, paces around the room, looking out for any student who may be struggling. She instructs one student to adjust her technique. Her pupil listens attentively, making the suggested alterations to her method.
Aquí no lo hizo bien, Sam. Mira, ahí está el lead. Mira. No está bien el choco y tiene que volver a hacer.
Of the entire group, it's Martha Julia who has the most patience. She knows just how hard weaving can be when you are just starting out. She was one of the first students to take the class through AFEDES back in 2009.
Se requiere de mucha paciencia, pero no.
It requires a lot of patience, but it's not difficult. All errors have solutions.
Martha Julia was fascinated with Mayan textiles as a young girl. It's this memory that drew her to the class. Weaving was something she had always wanted to learn, but neither her mother nor her grandmother knew how, so they couldn't pass the tradition on to her.
Yo de niña sí tuve ese deseo de tejer. Tuve una tía.
When I was a young girl, I always wanted to learn to weave. I had an aunt who was my uncle's wife, and she did know how to weave. I told her that I wanted to learn, and she said, okay, buy your materials, and I can teach you. But my family didn't have much money, so I didn't have the opportunity to buy the materials and learn to weave. But as a young girl, I always had this restlessness of wanting to weave, but never having the opportunity to learn. Because in my family, no one, not my mother or my grandmother, knows how to weave.
Entonces, cuando se me dio la oportunidad de aprender, yo aproveché y aprendí.
What Martha Julia really wanted to learn was how to weave her own huipil, the traditional woven shirt for Mayan women. It can take a weaver between 3 to 6 months, or even longer, to weave just one huipil, depending on how long she spends weaving each day. A hand-woven huipil in a market can cost up to 2,000 quetzales. That's about $270. In a country where the monthly minimum wage is just a bit more than that, at $340 a month, a huipil is no small purchase.
Me gustaba mucho esos huipiles, pero por lo mismo en la economía nunca, de niña nunca tuve un huipil.
I always loved huipiles, but because of my family's economic situation, I never had a nice huipil as a girl. The idea of learning to make my own huipil always caught my attention, and that was why I wanted to learn to weave. Because if I wasn't able to buy one, then maybe I could make my own.
Por eso fue eso mi deseo de aprender, para yo poder, si no puedo poder comprar, pero yo puedo hacer.
If you've ever seen a tourism ad for Guatemala, you've probably seen a huipil and just didn't realize it. They are hand-woven shirts, typically with bright colors, red, pink, blue, green, and yellow, usually with a combination of floral and geometric figures. Indigenous Guatemalan women are often featured wearing them in images promoting the country. From these advertisements and promotions, you would think that wearing a huipil is viewed in a positive light, but the reality in Guatemala is different. Many Mayan women report stories of harassment and discrimination just for wearing a huipil. One of the most common insults is to call an indigenous woman by the name of Maria. It's a common name in Guatemala, so why is it an insult? Well, calling a woman by Maria, if that's not actually her name, is a way of erasing her identity. It's saying that all indigenous women are the same, and it's not even worth learning her name.
Sufro, he sufrido eso y sufrí en camiones, en buses.
I suffer, and have suffered discrimination. In buses, when I travel to Guatemala City or Antigua, without fail, someone always calls me Maria. But that is just part of the racism that we live here in Guatemala, as indigenous women, unfortunately. Outside of the Guatemalan borders, the indigenous woman is the face of Guatemala. We are the image of Guatemala, but within the country, we are discriminated against.
Despite being called Maria and other insults, many Mayan women choose to invest the time and money into a huipil. Its cultural significance is invaluable. To a foreigner, it might seem like a huipil is just a huipil. A non-indigenous woman buying one of these blouses would probably choose one based on the design that she finds most appealing. But a Mayan woman chooses her huipil based on her heritage and community. Each region of Guatemala has its own design and color pattern. The design of Santiago Zacatepeques features rows of circular shapes that represent the sun and the moon. Other rows depict either lines of rabbits or quetzals. The rabbit is a nod to Mayan goddess of weaving, Itzel, who is often depicted with a rabbit. The quetzal is a bird native to Guatemala, green with a red breast and a long flowing tail. In the huipil from Santiago, red is the dominant color, with some hints of blue, green, pink, purple, yellow, and orange. As fewer and fewer women from Santiago Zacatepeques know how to weave, the region's particular huipil design is becoming less common. Some women have started to buy designs from other regions because they don't know how to weave their own regional design themselves.
The problem that we are seeing now, and it's with great sadness, is that little by little, the huipiles from specific regions are fading, like here in Santiago. The majority of people are now wearing other types of huipiles that are machine-made and that aren't made by hand weaving. That's what motivates me to keep weaving, to not lose our culture, because if we don't keep weaving, then at some point, weaving will end, and we will just have the story of it. We don't want that to happen, so that's why I advocate for weaving wherever I can. That's why I help women, however I can, so that weaving is not forgotten.
Pues yo ese impulso del tejido donde yo pueda, pues yo ayudo a mis compañeras y todo eso porque no me gustaría ver esto ya olvidado ya.
After learning to weave through the classes organized by Aferes, Martha Julia became one of the teachers at the school. She has now been teaching classes for about 3 years. During the course of the 4-month class, the students first make a table napkin. Then they work on making part of a huipil. Technology poses another threat to this centuries-long tradition. These textiles are meant to be one of a kind, with each woman giving each piece her own personal touch. Mass production of these textiles loses an important part of the culture. The designers that mass produce these textiles sometimes mix patterns from different regions that would not go together in a traditional Mayan textile. Sometimes they take the patterns without giving credit to the indigenous woman who wove it. Those are just some of the complaints the students have about machine-made textiles. Not to mention, they are often poorer quality and wear out more quickly.
We've started this initiative so that our textiles could be protected, and so that our history can be protected, and so that no one can take from us what belongs to us.
Keeping the tradition alive is really about the next generation. Students like Hilda wonder what they are going to leave to their children, and grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Will their kids know about Itzel, the Mayan goddess of weaving? Will they know the difference between a huipil from their hometown of Santiago Zacatepeques and other regions of Guatemala? Will they remember how their grandmothers and great-grandmothers had to stop wearing their traditional clothes out of fear during the Civil War? Most importantly, will they wear their indigenous clothing with pride and knowledge in where they came from? Their mothers certainly hope so.
I think weaving is so beautiful, and it's something that we shouldn't lose. That's why I want to learn. On the one hand, to know how, and on the other hand, to be able to pass it down to my kids, and if God allows, to my grandkids as well, so that this isn't lost. Those are Ilda's two children. They are fighting over whether or not they know how to weave. Emily, Ilda's four-year-old daughter, insists she does know how. Her five-year-old brother says he doesn't. Emily is a real talker. She tells me that she has a new baby cousin, that her brother is afraid of heights, and that her mom always has to remind her that there's still a few months to go before her birthday. During the class, Emily mostly plays with her brother, but at one point, she sits close to her mom to try to help her. The problem is, Emily's a bit clumsy. She is only 4 years old. She spills all the threads out from the container where they were neatly packed. Her mom lightly scolds her and tells her to be more careful. So Emily sits up straighter, trying to behave herself. She rearranges the threads in the original box as a four-year-old would, trying to shove them all in, but not in a particularly orderly way. They aren't quite as neatly packed as before, but her mom doesn't make too much of a fuss. Emily hands her mom the pink thread that she asks for, happy to be able to help out. She stares up at her mom as she weaves in quiet concentration. When Emily gets to be a few years older, that could be her sitting in front of the loom. Only she won't have to take classes through Afedis. She'll have her mom to teach her. Reporting for Wings, I'm Anna Catherine Brigida in Santiago Zacatepeques, Guatemala.
Anna Catherine Brigida filed that report from Guatemala. She is a longtime foreign correspondent across Latin America with a special interest in women's rights. For more information about this program or to hear it again, email wings@wings.org. Wings airs on community radio in at least 7 countries,